Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On season two, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right, well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. It is an absolutely crisp, beautiful fall day here in Anchorage, and been working on making an album for a local Alaskan band the last couple weeks, so it's kind of nice to settle in and catch up and do some Fern Line work. It's almost like coming home to a good friend. Hey, before we dive into the episode, I just want to give a real heartfelt thanks to everyone who continues to support this show each month on Patreon. I've had three or four new backers this month, and I'm getting closer to my next goal of 100 backers. And when I get there, I'm going to release another special bonus episode that chronicles one of my own trips from way back in the day. So if you're interested in becoming a Patreon backer, you can go to thefernline.com. Click on the Support the Fern Line tab, and you will find all the relevant links. Other than that, if you're looking for other ways to support the show, a good way to do that is to leave a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. Make sure you tell your friends about the podcast. And if you want to get in touch, you can leave me a direct message at thefernline@gmail.com. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or two-cheek shiver bivvy high on a Canadian Rockies north face, and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. I grew up in Alaska, surrounded by some of the most vast and rugged mountains on the planet. But if I was going to move to some other place to be a climber, I'd move to Western Canada and be a Canadian Rockies alpinist. With a history steeped in adventure, exploration, and commitment, the Canadian Rockies are home to some of the most iconic alpine peaks in North America. Mountains like Alberta, Columbia, Edith Cavell, and North Twin, to name a few, are synonymous with classic Rockies alpine climbing. Variable rock quality ranging from total choss to flint hard quartzite. Hanging glaciers and double cornices. Veins of pristine alpine and water ice, and the classic sandbag grade of 59A2. But if there's one mountain that stands out from the rest, it's Mount Robson. Topping out at nearly 13,000 feet in height and with huge relief on all sides, Robson is truly a sight to behold. Its massive south face rises nearly 10,000 feet from the Yellowhead Highway, luring tourists, hikers, and climbers alike for a closer look. But it's the northern side of Robson that speaks the language of the true alpinist. In 1913, mountain guide Conrad Kane led a group of climbers to the summit after navigating the crevasse-laden Robson Glacier and chopping steps up the northeast face and onto the summit. This ultra-classic line, aptly named the Kane Face, was in some ways ahead of its time and is still a serious root. The ante was upped in 1963 when Pat Callis and Dan Davis ascended the intimidating apron of 60 to 70 degree blue ice and steep snow, known as the North Face. But it wasn't until 1978 that the biggest face of all, the Emperor Face, was finally climbed by Mug Stump and Jamie Logan. The duo spent 4 days on the route, a line that more or less takes the central rib that splits the 8,000-foot face, and with that, established one of the most committing grade 6 lines in the Rockies. Another line on the face was climbed in 1981 by the legendary Dave Cheesemond and Tony Dick. And finally, in 2002, after multiple attempts over many years, Barry Blanchard, Felipe Pelay, and Eric Dumerick climbed Infinite Patience, a classic line following couloirs, ice runnels, and interesting mixed pitches up the right side of the face. Although Infinite Patience has now been climbed multiple times, and even soloed by the late Marc-André Leclerc, it is still one of the most serious lines in the Canadian Rockies. And like other classic Rockies routes, an ascent is largely based on finding the face in perfect conditions. That's why I was excited to hear about the line getting repeated again this September by the Canadian-Dutch team of Jas Photo and Martin Van Heren. I recently got a chance to talk with Jas about his experience on Robson, what it felt like to find the face in perfect conditions, and what it means to have climbed such an iconic line on the Emperor of the Rockies.
Actually tried Infinite Patience I think about 4 years ago with same partner who I'd done the North Face with, and we tried it in the spring and turned around due to continuous spindrift avalanches. So back then I probably felt already fairly ready to give it a good honest shot. Why that route, I don't know, it just seemed nice on a nice peak, you know, nice face. And then this time around, just had some time off with my buddy Martin, and usually early September we would have been chasing rock. So Robson was actually kind of our plan B. You know, we had a plan A. If it was more normal seasonal temperatures, we would have gone rock climbing in the Tonquin. And then we thought if it's crappy / snowy weather, you know, the Emperor Face could be our plan B. And little did we know, the more we had a look at the forecast, the more we started getting really psyched, because it looked like the forecast would be perfect for the Emperor Face. So yeah, I'm not somebody who's usually dead set on objectives. I try to find the best objective for the conditions and the weather. So that's really just how this came together. It's not even anything I had thought of at all in the last couple of years. But when this window of time off with a buddy arrived, it just seemed like that was the best possible objective that we could do with the cards we were given, you know? So
yeah. I'm assuming that in September for a big north-facing alpine objective like the Emperor Face, you're looking for a specific kind of conditions. What conditions are those?
Just below zero freezing temperatures, because as you know, the Rockies are incredibly chossy, right? So rockfall is a real problem, especially in those kind of massive 1,000-meter-plus features. So that was the first thing we were looking for. Then the second thing would have been no new precips, you know, in the days leading to our attempt, because again, avalanches and spindrift, just continuous spindrifts on that kind of a massive face can just, they had turned me around on my first try 4 years ago, so I wasn't too interested in hiking 25 kilometers just to turn around again, you know. And then the third thing was just good weather, high pressure. You know, Robson is a big peak, and I've topped out twice in a whiteout now, and you can really get lost up there. There's just ridges heading everywhere. So we wanted really good, clear visibility, or as clear as we could get. So those were kind of the three things, but mainly just good freeze with good weather.
Okay.
That's what we wanted. That early in the year, you know, the snow was less likely to be a problem, although there's been a lot of snow in the Rockies for this time of year already this year. So
yeah. Okay. So maybe just from the, so it sounds like you hiked in, which is great. You did it from the road. Go ahead and tell the story of the climb. Maybe just starting from getting there to Berg Lake. Talk about how it went down.
Yeah. So we drove up from Canmore first morning. We kind of felt in a rush. We left home pretty early. You know, it's a pretty far drive. So made it there around lunch and just hiked in. It's about 5 hours to hike into our bivvy spot. And really, you don't see the face until you've hiked for like 4.5 hours. So we were pretty hopeful, but you don't know until you see it. So finally, just as we turned the corner and started seeing where we'd be bivvying, we saw the face. And I think we both got really excited because it looked like it was in perfect shape with snow lines starting right where we wanted it. So essentially kind of bivvied the usual spot, got there early. Got a half decent couple hours of sleep, and then we got going fairly early, like, you know, 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. on the first day, and it starts with a rock band at the bottom, so we just kind of zigzagged and soloed up that in the dark, and then made it to a big ice patch that leads you to Bubba's Couloir, and I got a little worried that we'd have to turn around again because Bubba's Couloir was just Spindrift avalanching nonstop. Like, I've never seen continuous Spindrift like that. Like, literally 10 minutes of just nonstop Spindrift.
Wow.
And at the bottom where it just funnels, it just kind of like gets spat out. So there's no way we could have gone up there, even though that was our initial goal. So luckily we found another couloir to the right, you know, maybe climbed half a pitch and then were able to traverse into the couloir. And from there, it was still spindrifting, but it really wasn't a big deal. So we were able to climb the whole couloir with just continuous spindrift kind of in the middle, but we could just go up to the sides. So that wasn't too big of a deal.
What do you think was causing that spindrift?
I think the upper face, as we realized the second morning, gets a little bit of sun. And then, you know, even though I say we had perfect conditions, you know, I think we got started, that would have been the Tuesday morning. And I think it had stopped snowing in the night from like Sunday to Monday. So again, just a big, you know, like 12, 1500 meter face, even if there's just a quarter of an inch on there, a little bit of wind, a little bit of sun, then those kind of massive features will just collect so much dry snow, you know.
Right.
And it actually made me realize that maybe when I tried it 4 years ago, we shouldn't have turned around. Like, it was that kind of spindrift that spooked me and made me want to turn around. But I realized that's probably pretty normal in that phase. It's probably always pretty continuous in Bubba's Couloir.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So so you're in Bubba's Couloir. It sounds like the climbing's going good.
Yeah, we simul-climbed that whole thing. And then we got to the top of it where there's that classic traverse out left. So then we started pitching it out. I started leading and I could see where I think I was supposed to go, but I didn't love the way it looked. It was just fairly unprotected on loose rock. So I kept traversing, hoping to find a bit of a weakness and ended up in a bit of a dead end. So Martin came over and, you know, I was afraid I had screwed us over, but anyway, I ended up being able to get us out of there probably just by leading some slightly harder terrain, but it brought us to the bowl we were supposed to, which we simul-climbed. And that was probably, I thought, Martin didn't seem fazed by it at all, but some of the spookiest climbing, because we were simul-climbing on this kind of fourth-class scree, and the climbing wasn't hard, but often we'd either be simul-soloing or have one terrible piece between the two of us. And it was steep enough that, you know, if you one of us fell, we were both going down. And loose enough that, you know, you weren't getting great tools. So I was actually climbing pretty slow there, and it felt pretty serious despite the climbing being fairly easy. Just because, yeah, it was kind of sport. Like, people who climb in the Rockies know that fourth class is often the worst kind of terrain. It's just steep enough that if you fall, you die, but impossible to protect, essentially.
Right.
So that's kind of the way it was. But anyway, we've made it up and then made it to the base of the proper kind of upper couloir, which looked really good because ice started appearing at the bottom of that. So got our first ice screws of the route, and then I think we started getting really psyched because it looked like it was going to be good. And then my block was over, so Martin took over and led the next three pitches, which were incredibly classic. Just some really nice mixed climbing with ice everywhere except for a couple of dry places. So you'd get a screw, you'd get some rock gear, and the whole upper couloir was the best mixed climbing I've ever done in the Rockies. Like, it was just super, super classic.
Wow.
And we were hoping to make it to what is called on the topo the Emperor Inn, which was to be your bivvy site for the night. But a pitch or two before it, Martin noticed a little bit of rock fall. And we could tell we could probably find a good bivvy spot on the ridge to the right. So we ended up going in for an early bivvy, which we were both pretty happy about because all of our stuff had gotten completely soaked the night before just from the dew. So we actually had a really nice bivvy in the sun. We got like 2-3 hours of sun to dry all our stuff, and we had a nice flat base with dry rocks. So we had a really comfy bivvy. It was really windy overnight though, so we didn't sleep much, but at least we dried all our stuff.
Yeah.
And then the next day, we didn't get going too early. We just tried to time it with the sunrise, traverse back into the route, and the next 3 or 4 pitches were just amazing. Just super good. It was maybe like 60, 70 degree ice with a couple steeper rock steps, and then it would narrow down to some ice veins, and your feet would be on rock. It was really good. And we were really happy we stopped the bivvy where we did, because when we saw what was supposed to be the Emperor Inn, it just was way worse of a spot than where we bivvied. It was snowy and smaller and all that stuff. So I think we got pretty lucky calling it early that day.
Right.
Had a much more comfortable bivvy. And then we topped out on the ridge and had one last pitch called the Love Chimney, which was completely dry. It was kind of one of the looser pitches, but it all went. And then we made it to the ridge. I think because Robson is just so much higher, it just forms way more ice. That's one thing that really struck me compared to every other alpine mix route I've done in the Rockies that are usually a bit bonier. You know, Robson being pretty much 500 meters higher than everything else, there's just more freeze-thaw going on, and I feel like it doesn't just continuously thaw in the summer like most of the other peaks. So, yeah, from the ridge we simul-climbed, and then we saw the summit, and it looked like it was right there. It would probably have been noon, and I remember thinking, like, oh, yeah, we'll be on the summit by 2 or 3. Of course, that wasn't the case, but yeah, we kept going on the ridge, and the options at that point are either to keep going up the Emperor Ridge or do the Patience Traverse onto the west face, which was the line of the first descent. I had done a bit of the Emperor Ridge when I did the north face because we had overshot a bit too far right, so we had kept ourselves maybe in 100 meters of the Emperor Ridge, and I remember those double cornices being unpredictable. But the ridge this time around looked way mellower, like most of the snow cornices had fallen off, and it looked like it was mostly ice or seracs that were left. So we were tempted to go up there, and that was kind of our initial plan. And then we got to this rocky step, and we just slowed way down. So with the clock ticking, we decided to just do the Patience Traverse because we thought it'd be faster. But that traverse still took forever. Like, it's way longer than it looks. And then we ended up in what's supposed to be just kind of a couloir that leads to the summit. But, of course, it wasn't that straightforward. There was a couple rock bands, and it wasn't obvious where to pass. But by that point, you know, it was obvious. There was only one way off the mountain, you know. Like, we, even by the end of the first day, we didn't have enough gear to bail. So the only way off was to go over the top. So we kind of were super focused and just kind of got in the zone and found our way through that upper couloir. And by then, of course, the weather had deteriorated. So it was total whiteout, super windy and all that stuff. So we were pretty psyched to get to the summit finally. I think we summited around like 5 p.m. in a total whiteout again. So hung out there a bit until we had a bit of viz. And then managed to get down the normal route. We'd heard that the normal route was super icy this year and everybody was rappelling it, so we were a bit worried it would take forever, but turns out it was in great shape and we were just able to down climb it and walk down, and made it to the bottom of the cane face that night for a really nice, warm, comfortable night. So it was a pretty uneventful descent, really. A lot less than last time I was there.
Yeah, so you descended the Cane Face?
Yeah.
And did you guys bivvy just on that plateau below the Cane Face?
That was our initial plan, but then when we got there, it had been pretty warm, and I think freezing levels were probably around the top of the Cane Face, and because it had just snowed about a foot, you know, in the days prior to our ascent, there's about a foot of isothermal snow at the bottom of the Cane Face, so without a shovel, it would have been a really miserable place to camp, so we pushed as far as we could until we found a kind of a windswept dome in between two crevasses that had maybe just like 3 inches of isothermal snow instead of a foot. So we probably just maybe like 10 minutes below the plateau, below the Cane Face, just because we didn't want to be in the soupy slush all night kind of thing. And then, yeah, sure enough, as we started setting our tent, all of a sudden, you know, started poking, and then we started wondering if we were over a crevasse, and by then it's like a quarter to 11, you know, and it's dark and all that stuff. So,
okay. So you guys you're below the Cane Face. You've done it, but it's, you know, obviously I'm sure at this point in time, even though you're super psyched, you know, you're still on the mountain, and I'm sure you guys are pretty worked. Maybe just talk about that night.
We were worked, but we were more psyched, you know. It was, it really wasn't that bad. Like the first bivvy we got on the mountain, I think we put our feet up for like 8 hours because we stopped so early. I tried a new sleeping system, which ended up being a disaster. So I really didn't sleep much of the trip, but I think Martin got something like 2 8-hours of sleep on the whole thing. So he was feeling pretty good.
Right.
And yeah, we were worked, but we were psyched and we knew we were safe. And we knew from there it would be pretty casual terrain and we had a nice flat space and it was warm. So yeah, I think we both had a hard time falling asleep that night because we were like, frig, like we just climbed infinite patience. It was hard to believe, right?
Right.
But it didn't feel too wrecked, surprisingly. Actually, I think both of us, we talked about it the next day. Both of us that night were like, oh, maybe we should go up Resplendent the next day since we were there. But then, of course, the next morning, neither of us felt like going uphill when we woke up.
right.
But we felt pretty good, pretty energetic. So I think we were more psyched than anything else. And you know how it is when you've been up high and finally you lose altitude, you just feel your whole body come back to life.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, we felt actually pretty good. We had enough food and all that stuff. And we had a tent. So yeah, we were more psyched than anything else. And yeah, just kind of we were letting it all soak in, which was probably why it was hard to sleep, you know, just so happy and just such good climbing, and to do it with such a good buddy, you know, share that experience with somebody you get along with so well. It just, yeah, it makes everything super special. So, yeah, it was a pretty uneventful night, actually. We were starting to get psyched for the beers we had left at the river by the parking lot and all that stuff. So
Right. Obviously
had some big priorities, you know. So the next day, so the first time I had gone up, we'd come out to Robson Glacier. It was obvious that wasn't going to be an option because the glacier's just gone so crevassed. And even the first time I was there 7 years ago, I had fallen up to my nipples in a crevasse. So we were planning on going down the Patterson Spur, which is a new approach for the Cane Face that has been pioneered, I think, in the last 5 years. Somebody's put a lot of effort into marking it and building the trail and all that stuff. And it seems to be the new accepted approach for the dome and the Cane Face. So that was our plan. And the other thing I have to mention is actually when we got on the summit, surprisingly, there was some tracks. It looks like somebody had soloed the Cane Face a few days prior to our ascent. It couldn't have been that much longer before because it had just snowed until a couple of days before we went up. So we knew we had tracks to follow too, which would only make things easier to find the actual start point to this Patterson Spur. So
right.
I think that's why we were pretty relaxed by that point too. So we, from our bivvy spot, we made it to the Robson Resplendent Col, which kind of goes over a pretty sharp ridge. And I remembered when I was there like 7 years ago that, well, actually I didn't remember much. I just remembered it being super trivial, like a hike. And I don't know this time around if I'm just getting older or what, but it felt like it was a little more legit, like, you know, lots of terrain where you can't fall. It's not super hard, but it's just knife edge ridge with big cliffs on each side. So that definitely didn't feel like we could just completely turn our brains off yet.
Right.
And then we finally made it to the Patterson Spur, which was covered in snow. So we were going down it with crampons. And I think in my mind, I thought, you know, once we'd be at the call, it'd be a hike down, but it really wasn't. We went down for like 2 hours or 3 hours down talus and slabs and stuff like that. And then of course got lost here and there. So the whole day ended up being much longer than we thought it would be. And then finally, when we got to the bottom of the head wall where we're at the valley bottom, all we had to do was kind of bushwhack our way back to Kinney Lake and we could relax. It started raining. So our timing was perfect, but it was just kind of ironic because we'd been looking forward to that moment for the whole trip just to sit down and chill and enjoy it a bit. And yeah, it started pouring. So we were humid, but we were pretty happy anyway. It still felt warm compared to what we had felt on the mountains. So worked our way out the valley. And then there's one area where they say, you know, there's a bit of bushwhacking involved. And of course we lost the trail. So we bushwhacked for like an hour and a half. It was pretty funny. We were just like so fed up. It was just like head down and super thick bushwhacking. And then luckily about half an hour from the lake, we found the trail. And that, you know, that half an hour in the trail would have taken us like two to three more hours of bushwhacking.
Wow.
So we were pretty happy about that. And it's a really good trail actually. But having not come up it, it was pretty hard to find.
Right.
And then we had made a mistake on the way up. We had stashed our bikes 2 kilometers too high. So once we got back to the trail, we had to hike up another 2 kilometers. And it was pretty funny because like we're wearing our big mountain boots and soft shells and it's probably like 8 degrees and raining and we're shirtless just going up and everybody we'd cross just looked at us like we were, you know, from another planet.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Everybody was, you guys going for a swim or like trying to be funny, but
right.
Yeah, we were shirtless going up for our bikes. But yeah, that was pretty much it. We made it back to our bikes and enjoyed the downhill like well, we have never enjoyed downhill biking like before. So it was still a pretty long day. I think we got going at maybe 9:30 in the morning, 10, and made it back to the car at like 5:30. So I expected it to be like a 5 or 6 hour casual day. And it was just like 7 or 8 hours. But again, we had plenty of food and we were just so psyched that, you know, I couldn't have cared less. We were safe and we were, we had just climbed Infinite Patience, so we were super, super happy.
Yeah. So, like, in your mind, I mean, you know, I think for a lot of alpinists, like, a climb like Infinite Patience would be kind of a benchmark in their alpine career, or it would be, like, the climb of their career, honestly. And how does it feel for you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. The Rockies are kind of weird, like, so much about climbing the Rockies is about conditions, right? Like,
right.
It's just timing it perfectly. But when I look back, the climbing was never crazy hard, you know? It would be a whole other climb if the conditions weren't right. But in the conditions we had it never felt like super marginal or super at our limit. It actually felt fun and we were having a good time. And so, yeah, for sure, like a benchmark and one of my biggest climbs, if not my biggest, but at the same time, not like, oh my God, I pushed my limits to the max and, you know, I can't see myself doing anything more. Like,
right.
You know, if you go to the Alps or somewhere, the rock is solid and the gear would actually hold, you can climb stuff that's way harder than Infinite Patience
right.
all the time. So yeah. It's a very, very special experience and something I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. And I think the fact that, again, conditions are just so hard to get on that kind of route, that's what makes it so special. And the fact that it's been climbed a handful of times and it's pretty much only been climbed by professional climbers, like that all makes it super special. But I don't think either of us see it as it was totally at our limit or I can't see myself climbing anything harder. If anything, it's just kind of made me hungrier
right.
for more. Like now I'm just starting to look at other big faces I've always thought were maybe too hard or too challenging and thinking like, hey, you know, conditions are right. I can go give them a shot for sure. So it was just an awesome experience. And it's anybody who's done those kind of routes know how personal almost they feel, because you just,
right,
there's no way you can describe them to other, and there's no way you can get other people to feel what you felt. But that whole baggage of emotions I had on that climb are super special, and to have done them with a really good friend, and just to have been joking the whole time and laughing, made it even more special, you know, because we had a really good time doing it. That's what made it so special.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to ask just a little bit about how you might feel connected to the history of that face, because it truly is an important face in the history of, you know, North American alpinism. And so were you able to look up and see the Stump Logan route? I mean, can you see that line from where you were?
Yeah, we could see it really well from our bivvy. The first night you see the whole face. And then as you got higher on the route, you actually saw the upper head wall of the Emperor. You know how Infinite Patience, it kind of reaches the ridge way lower than all the other routes?
Right.
So the head wall to the left and above Infinite Patience just looks really gnarly. I was looking at it thinking, like, where would you go? And, like, you know, obviously, as things were going well in Infinite Patience, I was already starting to think of other projects. And I was like, you know, is this something I would come back and try and look
yeah.
at? And I remember just looking at the line, trying to think, like, is this something I'd want to try? And thinking, probably
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard for me to imagine, like, you know, when was it, like 1979? I mean, just the level of commitment to do a line like that is just astonishing to me.
Yeah, I know. And that's, you know, Martin also likes climbing history. So the whole time we're hiking in, we're talking about, like, Dave Cheeseman and, you know, his epic trip up there where he climbed it twice in a week and put up that new route in August. And yeah, we were essentially just scoping the lines from the bottom. And yeah, exactly as you say, talking about how incredible those guys were, and then talking about that led us to talking about the North Face North Twin, and, you know, just doing it in completely inappropriate clothing and equipment. And yeah, anyway,
yeah,
looking at that face is just super cool. And the cool thing about going on a face like that, or even just trying it, is I come back with even more psyched to read up on what's been done. And, you know, essentially I just couldn't wait to get back to the car to Google exactly where their route went and read again their, how can I say, their account of the first ascents and stuff like that. You know, I find going into an area just gets me way excited about what's been done there before.
Yeah.
So if anything, I was probably even more interested in the face after I'd climbed it than before.
Very cool. Well, that's great. So I guess the last question I have for you is, you've hinted at it a little bit, but what are some things that you would like to do in the mountains moving forward?
Up until 3 years ago, you know, it was all uphill and I was just progressing and I was 100% keen on climbing. And then, yeah, I think 3-4 years ago, I started getting elbow tendonitis. So it's no joke. I climbed more ice on Infinite Patience than I did in the last 4 years. Essentially, I had to stop ice climbing the last 3 years and pretty much almost stop rock climbing, like just stick to really easy stuff.
Right.
So I kind of lost it all. And then just last fall, I started getting better and started doing a bit of ice last year, but it still hurt a lot. So I still have some unfinished projects that I'd like to do, but the main things in the short term are going back to Quebec to do some mix routes. Like, the potential of the mix and ice climbing in Quebec is unbelievable. Last time I was there, with a buddy, Pete Takeda, and he wrote an article in Alpinist. We went to this remote place in Quebec via train, and we just opened like 6 or 7 really awesome routes on this big granite cliff.
Wow.
And I mean, routes like that are a dime a dozen over there. Like, it's granite and there's just drips everywhere, the most beautiful ice you can think of. So for the short term right now, my goal in the next couple months is just to be able to get back to climbing some ice, because I'd like to just go put up really cool mixed routes there.
Right.
And then I don't really have any specific projects. I don't plan long term too much. I just kind of go month by month, but during the long hike out, me and Martin were talking about maybe going to the Alps or Alaska, but I don't have anything really specific in mind. It was the same as what led me to climb the Emperor Face. Is just when the partners and the conditions and the weather line up, then you go for it. But I find if you try to force things off, then you just end up wasting your time. So I don't have anything real specific in mind, just trying to make the most out of my time off. And, you know, if somebody comes up with a good suggestion, I'm always open to listening to it, but I'm not super hard set on it. And I can't get enough time off to go to the Himalaya, so it'll probably just be lower elevation stuff, whatever it is. But yeah, nothing really specific.
Well, if the conditions are good in the Rockies next September, I won't be surprised if I hear that you go in to attempt the North Face and North Twin.
I'd like to try the North Face of Alberta before North Twin looks pretty crazy. I don't know. I guess I've grown up, taking my sweet time. Maybe I've blown up all the states of my mind, but you better believe me, 'cause I got something that's true. Lucilia, you got a hold of my heart. Lucilia.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Jas's experience on Mount Robson as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. I want to give a big shout out to the Fernline sponsors in 2018, the Alaska Rock Gym, the Moose's Tooth Pub and Pizzeria, Hoarding Marmot, and Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Thank you so much for your amazing and continued support. We had musical contributions today from my good friend Andy Thulberg, as well as my band, Easton Stagger Phillips, who also has a fellow Canadian member, Leroy Stagger. You can find links to all these tunes in the show notes and at thefernline.com. And finally, remember, if you're looking for a way to support this show, you can become a monthly backer on Patreon, and you can leave a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line. We should stay.